Welcome back. Here in the third hour of Issues Etc., we're going to start out talking about the best-selling book, Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas by Elaine Pagels. I'm sure you've seen it at Barnes & Noble or another bookstore sitting there, selling well, selling very well, and with other books like The Da Vinci Code that runs along the same lines, although in a more popularized, novelized form. People are starting to ask questions about these Gnostic Gospels, this ancient heresy, and what Elaine Pagels has to say about this ancient heresy and its writings. We'll be talking about that for the first part of this hour of Issues Etc., and then to conclude not only this hour but the entire program, Amy White joins us. She's a corporate and political speechwriter and author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Iowa Reality Check. She'll join us from her home where we'll get a review and an evaluation of the Democratic frontrunners for president as they get ready to go into the Iowa caucus. That's a little bit later here on Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our guest, Dr. Daniel Hoffman, is Associate Professor of History at Lee University in Cleveland, Tennessee. He's author of the book, The Status of Women and Gnosticism in Irenaeus and Tertullian. Dr. Hoffman has also written an article in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal titled A Summary Critique, Gnostic Christianity Revisited, Seek Your Inner Light. Dr. Hoffman, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
How would you describe Elaine Pagels' book, Beyond Belief, in a nutshell for a person who's only seen the cover and has not taken the time to look into it?
Well, that's a little bit difficult because on the surface it seems to be talking about the Gospel of Thomas. That's the subtitle, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. And so someone just seeing the book who didn't know anything at all about the topic might think that they were going to learn a lot more about the Gospel of Thomas. And yet really the main idea in the book is that a person should seek an inner light, a sort of inventive consciousness, as she calls it, in order to get in touch with the divine and experience the sort of a sense of satisfaction and a peace that she found in the church that she's been attending. It often has autobiographical information sprinkled throughout, and it seems that she really wants people to get beyond a creedal kind of belief in precepts, the idea of, for example, that there is one God and Jesus is true God of true God, begotten, not made, and so forth from the Nicene Creed, and get beyond that to experience God through their own sort of inner feelings. And so she reexamines early Christianity in that light, the first three or four centuries of Christianity, looking at a lot of texts, not just the Gospel of Thomas. So sorry for a long answer to a short question, but it is a bit confusing to see the subtitle, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, when it really talks about many other things in early Christianity beyond the Gospel of Thomas.
During undergraduate work, when I was studying to go, preparing to go to the seminary, one of the tasks was, of course, to learn the original languages, including Greek, so we could understand the New Testament. And just as a lark, the professor in Greek, after we'd become a little bit adept at the language, gave us a crack at a gospel that we were unfamiliar with, because if you know anything about young seminary students, when they're reading their New Testament, they're often going as much from memory as they are from really understanding the language that's in
Certainly.
Front of them. So he said, I'm going to test these young Turks out and see whether or not they can handle a Greek of the era that is something they're unfamiliar with, and he put in front of us an excerpt from the Gospel of Thomas itself. Now, while it seems to be something of a pretext for Elaine Pagels' book, what is this so-called secret gospel, the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas?
Well, it's a collection of sayings that on the surface are intended to be from Jesus, and they parallel a number of sayings of Jesus that are recorded in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and especially John. But I should say they have sort of a subtle twist to them in some cases that make them very difficult to understand and interpret. And in fact, scholars have found various kinds of meanings in many of these sayings, with a whole host of possible implications. And so I guess that's one reason why the Gospel of Thomas is rather fascinating, because it includes these sayings that seem in some ways to be similar to the canonical Gospels, the ones that most of us are used to, and yet they have very very different implications. So I hope that answers your question, at least to a degree anyway.
Now, the term Gnostic, or the ancient heresy, which of course doesn't apply only to Christianity but to many other religious systems as well, Gnosticism, give us an overview of that, if you would.
That's another very a complex topic, because scholars don't necessarily agree on what Gnostic or Gnosticism means or what it should include. It's hard to define or say when Gnosticism came into existence, because you have to first define what it is before you can say when you see it or when you find it. But the word Gnostic relates to the word knowledge. Gnostic just means knowledge. And these various groups that existed in the early church period that go under the term Gnostic, or following the belief system Gnosticism, emphasized a sort of secret knowledge that was not readily available to perhaps what we might call ordinary Christians, or those of most of the churches that seemed to exist at the time. In fact, they sometimes called the other Christians, the rather ordinary from their point of view Christians, the Christians of the great church, and they were rather the elite, or sometimes they would characterize themselves as the spiritual, and the other Christians were just soulish, or in a different category, a somewhat lower category. So in short, Gnosticism emphasized a secret teaching, secret knowledge that was not readily available to ordinary Christians. And perhaps some of that knowledge was found when the Gospel of Thomas was found, along with lots of other texts that seem to parallel teachings of the Gnostics as we know about them from the early church fathers. But it's very difficult to tell which group used which texts at which times, if you follow. So it gets rather complicated.
Now, one of the contentions in Pagel's book is that the Gospel of John in particular is written in reaction to the Gospel of Thomas, which kind of gives the impression that John the Apostle, or in her view, someone claiming to be John the Apostle, is playing catch-up with an alternate view of Christianity. Is there any evidence for this, that Christianity did not exist in an orthodox form in the beginning, but there was kind of a competition of competing viewpoints, of which orthodoxy finally won out?
Evidence from the first century is very very much disputed and in debate, because it would involve reading back in sort of behind the canonical Gospels, trying to see in Matthew, Mark, and so forth, groups that taught something that was then being refuted by what is listed in the canonical Gospels. So that's kind of hard to say, and oftentimes in the absence of direct evidence, one's own opinion has a tendency to come out. So if you think there were many groups and you think they existed at that point, you can find behind the words of scriptural texts a group that must have been saying things opposite to what the scripture was saying in order to justify the need for writing down the scriptural precept to confound that view that must be out there. But it's a search for a needle in a haystack in one sense.
And it's a speculation.
It's just speculation, yes, absolutely. I'd give them a much shorter answer.
Okay, so then is there any reason to think that John's gospel, as Pagel suggests, and the Gospel of Thomas were even proximate to one another when they were written?
The main reason to think that is because they deal with very similar content. But the content could be similar because the Gospel of Thomas whoever wrote it or however it was compiled, was aware of the teaching in John and was reacting to that just as easily as Pagel's contention that the Gospel of John was written as a reaction to the Gospel of Thomas. So I think the evidence, what objective evidence there is, points to the theory that the Gospel of Thomas was later and was reacting to the Gospel of John rather than the other way around, as Pagels contends.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on Elaine Pagel's book, Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, feel free to give us a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're talking with Daniel Hoffman, and he's the author of the book, The Status of Women and Gnosticism in Irenaeus and Tertullian. Picking up from the title there, the subtitle of your book, does Pagels have anything to say about the early church fathers when it comes to her view of what original Christianity looked like?
Well, she uses the early church fathers a lot. She quotes from Irenaeus, from Tertullian, and other sources like that. Again, it's rather a selected quote to help support the view that she has of Christianity, what she would define as Christianity, that one should not be tied to a particular creed or whatever. For example, she'll look at Irenaeus and look at the information that he gives where he says some groups come to him, some Gnostic groups that come to him, they kind of complain that they are being unfairly stigmatized, considered to be heretical by the group that Irenaeus represents, what we would probably call the Orthodox group. And she thinks that incident was truthful. She considers that to be accurate and so forth. And then she'll take that information and kind of run with it and say, well, the Gnostics were being unfairly criticized, and their views really were similar to the Orthodox views. Not perhaps outright as blatant as I said, but rather a inference that the Gnostics were being unfairly attacked and criticized. So she uses the early church fathers as a springboard for the larger theory of her book, that the Gnostics were really the good guys who were unfairly attacked, if you follow me. And sometimes she'll do this in areas like the status of women, which is certainly important and a hot topic now. Like in her original book, The Gnostic Gospels, she tried to argue that the Gnostics treated women much better than the Orthodox group did, the Orthodox churches. And that actually ties in with the Gospel of Thomas, because, you know, one of the most striking sayings that seems to come from Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas is a saying that absolutely contradicts that particular reconstruction of the Gnostic view and of early church history. It has Jesus saying that women need to become male or become men in order to enter into the kingdom of heaven. And so that's a text that she did not quote in the Beyond Belief book.
Beyond kind of mere scholarly pursuit and interest, why does she seem so interested in the writings of what have been uniformly judged up until this point in the history of the church, heretics, ancient heretics?
You know, that's really a fascinating question. I think that in Beyond Belief, she gives us sort of a glimpse of that, and I've read some other articles about her life where I think that she actually attended an evangelical church as a teenager felt at home there for a while until eventually a friend of hers was killed in a car accident, and she got into a debate with the people at the church about whether the friend was a Christian and going to heaven and so forth. And she didn't like the answer that said that, well, the person needed to be a believer in Jesus and accept Christ as their Savior and so forth. And so I think she's been fascinated by Christianity for a long time, and then she suffered a number of personal tragedies in her life that she also talks about in the book. And so she's sympathetic to Christianity in a certain sense, but she doesn't like narrow kind of creedalism. That's sort of her more modern and in some ways perhaps inclusive background coming through, you might say. So in lots of ways, she's very much open to reading Christian texts, understanding them, trying to apply them, make them popular, as Beyond Belief has done very, very, very clearly, as you've said. But it's a bit more difficult to agree with her interpretations of some of those texts, as we've discussed.
The average person picking up this book, Beyond Belief, might be tempted to believe that, at the very least, Pagel's contention that Christianity was ill-formed, that the New Testament Gospels are really the product of a competition between competing views, and that they just so happened to win, not because they are really true in any sense, and that one is just as likely to find truth in something like the Gospel of Thomas or the other Gnostic writings. How would you warn someone who's looking at the book to, what would you say to them to warn them away from this kind, accepting her premise?
Well, the Christians at the time, with greater knowledge perhaps than we have now, certainly greater access to the sources than we have now, looked over a number of writings, probably many, many more than have been preserved that we know about now, and they recognized that these other books did not have the hallmark of inspiration. They didn't come from a recognized spokesman of God. They were not received by the people of God in the first and second century. This is why her contention is a very important one, because and dangerous in one sense, because if in fact everything is up for grabs, all the groups were equally widespread, equally valid, and so forth, and it's very hard to argue against the view that we should read the Gospel of Thomas just as well as we should read the Gospel of John, or maybe even consider the Gospel of Thomas better. But in fact, the Gospel of John is earlier, and it was written by a recognized spokesman of God. It contains truth that accurately portrays the life of Jesus and so forth. So she's weaving in multiple higher critical theories when she sort of compares Thomas to John and judges Thomas to be superior. So it's the earlier and more authentic nature and the inspiration of John and Matthew and so forth that distinguish them from books like the Gospel of Thomas.
So not only is she kind of writing a pet theory and basing it on a genuine ancient heresy and a genuinely ancient document, although a heretical document.
Yes.
She is engaging in quite a bit of revisionist history when it comes to the formation of the canon, to the doctrines being taught by the early church.
Absolutely.
And by the church fathers.
Absolutely, yes. And I think that's why it's so popular in one sense, because it's kind of like Christianity as a 21st century person might have liked to see it in the first and second century, even though it's really not that way.
So it appeals, this is why the book sells.
Absolutely.
It appeals to the way we'd like Christianity to be if we could make it up all over again.
Absolutely. And she's really quite good at using these ancient texts that nobody hardly reads and making them very, very popular, because she pulls out of them the ideas that are most acceptable in a modern culture.
Is there also an appeal, and it's found there, I think, in her title, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, the appeal to the same kind of quasi-conspiracy mentality that says, you know why you haven't heard about the Gospel of Thomas? They've been hiding it from you.
maybe so. It certainly has that kind of allure to it. The truth of the matter is that one can buy the Gospel of Thomas in multiple forms now and read it to one's heart's content. But people don't do that, but they buy beyond belief because it seems like it's something that's secret, you know, the secret gospel. That's really misleading as well because it's a possible translation to say the secret gospel of Thomas, but you could say the hidden or higher or other things, but that's probably the most catchy title possible to sell it to a 21st century audience.
In the end here, and finally, Dr. Hoffman, what does Elaine Pagel's quote-unquote Christianity really end up looking like?
I think it looks an awful lot like a New Age sort of revision of Gnosticism where one seeks one's own inner direction, one's own inventive consciousness, as she called it, as I said near the beginning. And so as long as it's sort of superficially Christian, you attend a church perhaps that it is historically Christian, or read Christian documents along with other documents, your own inner light can direct you. And that's, I think, quite a dangerous idea.
Dr. Daniel Hoffman, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Daniel Hoffman is Associate Professor of History at Lee University in Cleveland, Tennessee. He's author of the book The Status of Women and Gnosticism in Irenaeus and Tertullian. He's also written an article in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal titled A Summary Critique, Gnostic Christianity Revisited, Seek Your Inner Light, a Review of Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas by Elaine Pagels. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Amy White. She's a corporate and political speechwriter, and we're going to evaluate the Democratic frontrunners for president on the eve of the Iowa caucuses. We recently did a review and a long conversation on the Da Vinci Code. It's a novelized version, if you will, of many of the ideas put forth by Elaine Pagels. I remember when I was in graduate school and it was Dr. Lewis Brighton who brought in this big fat book called, I can't even remember what it was called, Something and Pseudepigrapha. Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, something along those lines. It contained many ancient writings that have been uncovered by archaeologists, some of them of supposed Jewish origin, some of them of supposed Christian origin, some of them of origins that sounded like nothing we'd ever heard before. They're ancient writings. They're old. They weren't secret, though. Just because you haven't heard of the Gospel of Thomas doesn't mean anyone's been hiding it from you. And because the Gospel of Thomas may sound superficially Christian, may talk or claim to be the words and the deeds of Christ, doesn't mean it's an authentic gospel. It appeals to our inner pride to seek God within the inner light of our souls. But God is not found there. The real gospels tell us where God is found, in human flesh. Not ours, but that of Jesus Christ, our Savior. And that is where we will find God, and that is where we will find inner light as well, in Christ. We'll be right back to talk with Amy White.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production, salaries, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check. Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Life in outer space, what have they found?
Answers with Ken Ham. author of the best-selling book, The Lie Evolution. Well, Ken, scientists have spent millions and millions of dollars looking for life in outer space, and have they found any?
Well, the quick answer is no. The late astronomer Carl Sagan often wrote about the search for extraterrestrial life. He wrote an article for Scientific American full of beautiful pictures and diagrams. At the end of the article, he summed up the search by saying, quote, "That monumental discovery remains to be made," end of quote. You see, they haven't found anything yet. Back in 1977, the United States spent millions of dollars on sending the Voyager spacecraft to take messages out to extraterrestrials. That's right, even Jimmy Carter, the then President of the United States, wrote a message telling the extraterrestrials that we wanted to join a community of galactic civilizations. Also on board the Voyager craft was a story of evolution, illustrated by sounds and pictures to tell extraterrestrials how we supposedly evolved. Is there intelligent life outside our world? Well, there certainly aren't any green men. But is there a higher intelligence? Certainly, the Creator God of the Bible.
Ken Ham looks at this intriguing topic in much more detail in a free booklet available on our website, AnswersRadio.com. You can read Ken's answers right on your computer screen or download and print out the booklet. It's a free service of AnswersRadio.com.
Life sometimes seems like a wild ride down a raging, churning river. Find aid, refreshment, and direction for the journey with psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson on Focus on the Family. With team effort, you can navigate the rapids of circumstance.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. The latest brain research shows that the front part of the brain is responsible for self-control and moral judgment. This part of the brain develops through childhood and adolescence. The American Academy of Pediatrics reports some research has suggested that mindless television may idle this particular part of the brain and impoverish its development. So how much TV can our children watch? Again, the American Academy of Pediatrics says 1 hour a day is a lot for preschoolers, and 1 to 2 hours is the maximum for older children. Motivated by God's love, which He has shown us in Jesus, we can place limits on our children and their TV time. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at www.cmli.org.
Welcome back for the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Our good friend Amy White joins us. We're going to be evaluating the Democratic frontrunners for president. Now, I'm looking at the polls today. This comes from Real Clear Politics, and they have the polls as of, I think, the 14th. That would be yesterday. And it's amazing. It's amazing to see that between Dean, Gephardt, and Kerry, the three that we're going to be talking about today, at least according to the Zogby tracking poll, their historical version dating from the 12th to the 14th, all three of those guys are running neck and neck, with Kerry having a one-point lead. Dean, 21%. Gephardt, 21%. Kerry, 22%. There's Edwards at 17%. And the changes are interesting to note as well. Dean was the presumptive frontrunner. Remember that term? We all got to be very familiar with the term presumptive frontrunner. We'll see what happens after Iowa, because as anyone running for president knows, if you can make it there, well, you might make it anywhere. You also have to get through the gateway called New Hampshire, and then you have the rest of the primary season. But primary season is upon us. Begins with the Iowa caucus this coming week. Amy White joins us. If you'd like to join us as well with a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Amy White is a corporate and political speechwriter, author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Iowa Reality Check. She joins us from her home in Oakville. Amy, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Todd.
I'm always curious when it says corporate and political speechwriter, who have you written for, Amy?
Well, I've written for different politicians on a for-hire basis, but I actually got my start doing political writing for now Attorney General John Ashcroft. Senator Ashcroft had a radio program, and while I was working for him in an official capacity, I also did some scripting for him.
So if we'd like you to do a little work for us, you wouldn't have a problem with that?
No, I don't think so.
What was it like to work with Attorney General Ashcroft?
Well, it was wonderful because he was a very ethical individual and a lot of fun and a smart guy. So it was really fun to work through different radio scripts with him. He's a great individual, and I was very relieved, though, when they did the hearings to approve him as Attorney General, that none of the citations that they offered from speeches he had given were my responsibility. I kept waiting to see, is someone going to ask him about something I wrote? If so, I'm going to fall right through the floor, but I was able to escape that.
Kim, I want to ask you how that works. You got a guy who wants to say something.
Right.
And, of course, these are busy men and women. They are also, if I'm given to understand from friends who have run in Washington's political circles, they're not always brilliant people, but they are sincere and dedicated people.
That's true.
You are going to write something that's going to come out of their mouth. And they're going to be held accountable for what they said. They can't say, well, that was my speechwriter, I'm sorry. How does that work?
Well, how it works is that usually the gentlemen who find their way into politics, the men and women who find their way into politics, have a natural gift of gab. And if they don't, they usually don't do real well. And so when you're working with politicians, I would be very shocked to work with a politician who said, wow, you know, speaking isn't really my forte, and I sure need some help. You would never hear that out of an elected official's mouth or someone who is trying to pursue office. What you would hear is, I'm a dynamic speaker. I know exactly what I want to say, but boy, I'm busy. So why don't you jot a couple things down, and I'll make it my own, and when I deliver it, it'll be marvelous. So in a lot of ways, the personality type of a politician is uniquely suited to that role because they take it, and they really make it their own. And, of course, their advisors and their chief of staff, and everyone reviews it. But I know Peggy Noonan has written several books about this process of political speech writing, and it is painful because you can write something that you feel has this beautiful rhythm to it and flow and its lovely, vivid language, and some policy hack takes a hold of it and says, oh, we have to clarify that that's not absolute fact, and we have to insert that this is a probable cause, not an absolute cause, and by the time it's done, the loveliness has been drained out.
One of my favorite political speeches, just in terms of its flow, was the first President Bush's 1,000 Points of Light.
Yes, and she was responsible for that.
And I noted, though, that when his son took up the same issues, it became faith-based initiatives,
right,
which just doesn't have the same rhetorical value in my mind.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, it is a wonderful thing to have someone working on how to communicate an idea in a memorable way. And so I'm glad that there's a market for it.
Well, speaking of communicating ideas in a memorable way, we are really getting some of the most memorable ideas from some of the front runners, you know, on the Democratic ticket for president as we approach the Iowa caucus, Dean being the first one. Now, your column is very much tongue-in-cheek.
Yes, it is.
And really quite funny. However, let's talk seriously about the ideas and the man who is Howard Dean. What would be, if you were to put his, using your speechwriting abilities, put his ideas and his concept into a paragraph, how would it sound?
Oh, God. Well, that's a great question, Todd. I wish I had a great answer. Well, Howard Dean seems to constantly be evolving in terms of his positions on things. But I think that what stands out to me as a speechwriter when I hear Howard Dean is that he's absolutely without shame. And by that I mean that he is willing to make some extremely bold, accusatory comments. And he will repeat them, and he will not flinch when he is faced with or presented with facts to the contrary. And then if the heat gets to a certain point, either in the national media or among the press corps, perhaps among Democrats, he simply says he didn't say it. And it's a terrible character quality, but it's miserable rhetoric as well, because, you know, we have all these things on tape. We have records of him saying these remarks, and he's a very belligerent person in terms of his verbal communication, because he will say what he wants to say independent of facts, and then he just refuses to back down. And he's done this with a lot of different things, but I happened to see something on C-SPAN that absolutely shocked me, where they were at the Howard Dean headquarters in Iowa, and he was working his way down the line, and a woman stopped him and said, "I'd like to know about your commitment to supporting a woman's right to choose." And he began to respond to her, and he volunteered to her, "You know, there's no such thing as partial birth abortion." And he repeated it several times. And I thought to myself, my goodness, the boldness of this man is amazing. Partial birth abortion is a reality. He might have issues with what it's called, but it's a reality, and it's documented. It's acknowledged by everyone who's involved in the Roe v. Wade debate. And yet he is he's becoming quickly infamous for ridiculous comments that he clings to very tightly.
Is this the result of bad handling, a too young staff, something like this? Or is this an insight into the, because politicians are heavily handled, is this an insight into the man himself, do you think?
I think it's a character issue. I think that the people around him, of course, could coach him in ways that might hide this character issue, but it's clearly there for all to see. He has insisted several times in his stump speech that there was no middle-class tax cut with the two rounds of tax cuts that George W. Bush got pushed through Congress and that the American people have already collected refund checks on. He continues to insist that there was no middle-class tax refund, even though it has been clearly shown that there was. The facts are there, whether he chooses to acknowledge them or not. He simply won't back off from saying it.
I got two checks.
I did too, and I assume we're both middle class.
Yeah.
Surely we're not low class.
Well, so, what is his major challenge going into Iowa? Is he a shoo-in?
No, clearly not. As you just mentioned, the polls show that the people in Iowa clearly seem to have gotten a good earful of Howard Dean. And some of the support that he was counting on, let's say a week or 10 days ago, has begun to erode in other directions. And one of the most surprising things is that John Edwards is beginning to poll a great deal higher than he was just a week ago, and some of the events that he's hosting in Iowa suddenly are getting some very good attendance. And reporters who are following him have commented in written pieces they've done that there's several people in Iowa that are very impressed with his personal style, that when he gives stump speeches, he's not violent in criticizing other Democrats. He's not over the top criticizing the current president. And they seem to appreciate the kinder, gentler approach that they're seeing from Mr. Edwards.
You mentioned Edwards. He's gone from 8% on the 7th of this month to 17% by some polls in Iowa. He's certainly at a solid 17% according to Zogby. And that puts him just points behind Dean. And he's also got to contend with Gephardt and Kerry as well. Kerry seems to be the front runner at 22%.
That's correct, and that's certainly a surprise. You know, everyone has assumed that the battle would be between Dean and Gephardt, and at one point last week it appeared that Dean would clearly win. So it's interesting that the good people of Iowa continue to evaluate these candidates, and I know that they're going to get a lot of opportunity to do so over the weekend.
Let's talk about Richard Gephardt. How would you summarize him as a candidate in just a few words?
I would say that Richard Gephardt has specialized in flipping back and forth on issues. And he started out as a fairly conservative Democrat and found a base for that because he was a social conservative, but he advocated traditional Democratic principles, including support for organized labor. And as his political career expanded and as his political ambitions grew, he continued to become more and more liberal. And I think that many people here in Missouri have a bad taste in their mouth about Congressman Gephardt because we have seen that evolution up close in a way most of the country has not. And when you talk to people who knew him at the beginning of his political career, there's almost a sense of personal insult that Richard Gephardt ended up turning his back on many of the principles and general political philosophy that he espoused.
Is he casting himself as the kinder and gentler Dean? I mean, he's been quoted many times as saying that President George W. Bush is a miserable failure, which seemed to be the sharpest rhetoric at the time. But now I've seen him, especially since Dean's kind of gotten the rage label put on him, Gephardt seems as to be portraying himself as Mr. Unflappable, soft-spoken, just about as reasonable as anyone could possibly be.
Well, you're right, and I have seen Richard Gephardt give interviews to national media through the years where he's shown a wonderful ability to be the epitome of the rational, reasonable, calm politician. He's also, though, very willing to completely step over. I remember when Clinton, when the vote for impeachment had happened in the House, Richard Gephardt stood at the podium in front of that massive crowd of press people and pounded the podium as if he would break it in half and was practically foaming at the mouth. And Gephardt has actually given some speeches today that have taken very, very sharp aim at Howard Dean. So this, unfortunately, is a characteristic of Congressman Gephardt, that he perhaps has an identity that is true to him, but he on a regular basis will swing very far and wide trying to find what will work. And I think that's to his disadvantage, to any politician's disadvantage. I think it would be best to stick with something and let it ride, let the people evaluate him on that point. But you will see him veer between I am a reasonable, rational, professional politician with steady hands versus taking very sharp aim at people and rhetorically just going over the top. Another terrible tendency he has is that he really exploits issues in his personal life. He has gone on the floor of the U.S. Senate just in the past 2 years and said that his 92-year-old mother, who was in a retirement center here in St. Louis, had bounced a bunch of checks and had called him up in D.C. and said she was very, very worried that they were going to cut her Social Security, and what would she ever do? He gave this statement on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives, where it's entered into the permanent historical record of U.S. government, that his mother's bouncing checks. Now, I don't know if she did have an issue with her checkbook, but he was clearly exploiting a situation. And it appeared to most hearers that Laureen Gephardt did not have to worry about getting those checks covered with two sons who were very involved in her life. And he's also done this with his father. For years, he has told stories about how grateful his father was to be a Teamster and drove a milk truck and the modest home that they had, but it was all because of organized labor that he was able to provide a wonderful living for the family. And yet the reality of that, his brother and mother have verified to national press sources for years that his father was a Republican who was disenchanted with the Teamsters, felt like the arrangement that he had to be in the Teamster to drive the milk truck was an insulting one and took advantage of him, hated his role as a milk truck driver, and was quite despondent that both his kids ended up Democrats. So I think that when you completely misconstrue what your father believed was important and right, and you're willing to do that to gain, you know, a couple political points with a certain special interest group, I think that really says something about personal character.
My producer believed with all of his heart that John Kerry would be the man to contend with, and he may well be actually looking at the polls because he does lead, according to Zogby's tracking poll, by 1 point in Iowa, so he may well walk away with Iowa, and who knows, he's got a very strong standing, it appears, or stronger standing in New Hampshire out east.
I'm with your producer. I think Kerry's going to be the guy, too.
Now, tell us about John Kerry, besides what we all know, that he's married to a very rich woman with an accent, and he was in Vietnam.
Yes, he was in Vietnam, which he has mentioned fairly frequently on the campaign trail. Well, John Kerry was willing to come out and vote for the resolution for going into Iraq, and then he essentially embarrassed himself in a magazine article by criticizing George Bush extensively, saying that Iraq was a mess and that he had messed it up, and his comments were, you know, had some fairly frequent, far-flung obscenity to them, and so they made a lot of waves for a while. But John Kerry seems to be a fairly moderate Democrat who is also trying to find his way through this nomination process. Howard Dean came on the scene, took the far-left position, and I think that John Kerry stood there for several months with his jaw hanging open, wondering what had happened, you know, as he saw this surge follow Mr. Dean. Now I think you're looking at Democrats saying, wow, can Howard Dean win, and do we want Howard Dean to be our nominee? And so they're kind of casting their eyes back to Congressman Senator Kerry, who really took a much more moderate position on several critical issues, whether it related to homeland security, national defense, even tax cuts. John Kerry is willing to pinpoint that both Howard Dean and Richard Gephardt are making proposals right now that the tax cuts that benefited most Americans, they want to repeal. And John Kerry is pointing out, hey, all you people who are interested in getting some of that tax money back, these two guys want to take it back again to pay for some of the programs they're advocating. So John Kerry, with a stronger position really on national defense and willing to acknowledge that tax cuts in a general sense can be a good thing, may end up marshaling most of the support at the end of the day. Who can say?
Let's talk about money between these three frontrunners in Iowa. Dean, I assume, is still the frontrunner when it comes to having raised money, and the people who trail him by a pretty great distance. What was it, almost $40 million raised today?
It's a pretty significant sum, yes.
He compares there with President George W. Bush, who's already raised well over $130 million.
Right.
And how important will it be after the caucuses and the primaries all shake out, how much money each candidate, Democratic and Republican, has in the bank?
Well, I think it's going to be pretty important, but what you really see is that there's two different ways that the Democratic Party is going to go about choosing their nominee, and the Republicans are no different. One is who is willing to go out and cast a vote for these gentlemen in a primary, and the other is who is prepared to pull out their checkbook, because there are several people, there's thousands of people in both political parties that are willing to cast a vote who are not willing to write a check. The people who write checks are a different breed. Their interest, their passion, their personal commitment to politics and to the candidate that they support is different when they're writing a check out. And so we will not only have to look at see, okay, who's voting, who's winning the primaries, but who's raising the money. That's why, as you mentioned, this becomes a regular focal point. Who's raising the money? Who is seen as someone who's a good investment on the dollar? And so it'll be interesting to see coming out of Iowa, depending on how the top three come out, who will start getting a bump in their fundraising, whether or not Dean takes a dip, whether or not Gephardt surges, whether or not Kerry goes forward. Kerry has set up an interesting scenario where he's criticized Howard Dean for not going along with the limits that allow him to accept money from the government, that system of saying, I'm not going to accept this taxpayer money, so I'm going to raise all the money I can and spend it all if I can. But Kerry has said that is a bad choice, but he's reserving the right to do the same thing in case anyone tries to assassinate his character. And, of course, this is something that is fairly appropriate because John Kerry has some significant wealth within the family that he could tap into if he decided to with a presidential campaign.
What is the issue of the race that's now being held here that's manifesting itself as the Iowa caucus, the New Hampshire primary? I've had a hard time finding one. What's the issue between these three Democratic frontrunners?
I think the only real issue that exists for Iowa Democrats and Democrats in general is who can beat George W. Bush. I don't think you see a careful analysis of what is the Democratic Party going to be about, what are we going to stand for, where are we going to propose the country needs to go, and how we can get them there. It's much more of a primitive, who is it that we have that can put up the best fight against a fairly popular, well-moneyed president who has shepherded the country through an unparalleled time of upheaval with the war on terror, the stock market up, the stock market down. Who can take on George W. Bush? And I think everything else comes down to that issue, that's how the decision will be made. It's not really being made on any kind of tax issue, war on terror issue, those kinds of issues. It's being driven by who can win in a much more primitive way. There's a lot of Democrats that believe George W. Bush doesn't belong in the White House, that Al Gore won fair and square. If it hadn't been for the disaster in Florida, that would have been clear and their guy would have been in. So there is a very personal interest in selecting whomever can successfully defeat George W.
Anybody but George,
yes.
What will be the issue of the presidential race once the primary season is over, or actually once it's well far enough along that we know who the Democratic candidate will be?
I think that the issue will be the war on terror. It's really the defining, issue of our lifetimes. It began with September 11th in the minds of most Americans. It's proceeded into Afghanistan. It's taken us into Iraq. We're seeing some positive benefits in terms of other countries being aware, hey, you know, there's somebody running the United States right now that is prepared to pull out all the stops in pursuit of terrorism. So I think that the entire debate is really going to center on this idea of how much is this costing us? Does it have to cost as much? Is this the only way to win? Will we truly be safer? I think everything's going to sort of stem from that issue of war on terror.
Finally, Amy, with only about a minute before we have to go, if the election were held today, would either any of these front runners be able to defeat George W. Bush, in your opinion?
My opinion is no.
What about come November?
My opinion and my hope is no.
By the way, Amy, would you have any time to write more columns for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch if they would ask you to do that?
Yes, I think I would have time. I've almost got my girls trained to the point where I can keep them busy in the office while I type.
You're going to have to send me some pointers on that. My only way to do it is to send them completely out of the room.
Well, I've tried that too. And every time I do, I think, oh gosh, someone's going to write a column about using the TV as a babysitter, and I'm just going to have to hang my head in shame.
Well, you're also working too. Amy White, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd, very much.
Folks, I want to encourage you to contact the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. If you like what you hear here on Issues, Etc. from Amy, if you like her ideas as you read them in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and if you've read them elsewhere, contact the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and let them know that you enjoy the writing of Amy White and her columns. Now, you can read the column she's written called Iowa Reality Check online at stltoday.com. That's the website for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, stltoday.com. Sunday on the program, a review of The Purpose-Driven Life by Rick Warren. You may have heard the two-hour roundtable that we did here locally. Well, Sunday night, live Sunday night on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis, from 10 until 11, we'll be reviewing the book again for the national show, The Purpose-Driven Life by Rick Warren. Our guests, Pastor Tom Baker and Dr. Larry Rast of Concordia Theological Seminary. It's not a repeat show. It's not a repeat. It will be an all-new review, tightened up a little bit, of course, and it's also timely. That's live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Now, if you'd like to post a question or a comment or an idea in advance of Sunday night's program, you can do so on our Issues Etc. forum. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find the forum there waiting for your questions and your comments on The Purpose-Driven Life and our review of it coming up live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Those of you listening to us on the Internet, you can go to our website that night, issuesetc.org. Click on the KFUO logo, and you can listen live to both hours of that review of Rick Warren's book Sunday night. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.